Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, even Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Today on the show, the riots in Charlotte last week led to political posturing this week. And the first presidential debate appears to have further entrenched partisan views. But what impact might it have had on undecided voters here in North Carolina? I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News here at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Jeff.
Hey there.
So, Jeff, last week was a rough one in the city of Charlotte, any way you look at it. The shooting of Keith Scott sparked protests and violence and a back and forth about releasing police body cam and dash cam videos that continues really up until this morning. This week, with the protests subsiding, a lot of the talk has turned to sort of the political posturing. We've seen further evidence that there's no love lost between Democrat Jennifer Roberts, the mayor of Charlotte, and Republican Governor Pat McCrory and Senate Leader Phil Berger. McCrory accused Roberts and his opponent in the governor's race, Roy Cooper, of meeting during the crisis and using the events for political gain. This struck me as a pretty remarkable attack, even in a race and a political season that has seen a lot of attacks. And it seems like it's one more example that this race is going to get a lot uglier before Election Day. What do you think about that?
One of the things I wondered over the past week, we heard some wrangling about Jennifer Roberts, the mayor of Charlotte, taking too long to call in the National Guard, and McCrory, Governor McCrory, saying, you know, he offered help as early as Wednesday morning of last week, so hours after the shooting. She did not call for that support for, I think it was until about 20 hours later. So one of the things I wonder about with these two is, as they spar in public, their relationship is clearly tainted. There's no love lost here, as you said, and I wonder whether or not it's functional on any level, right? Because you've got Roberts, who has been a champion of this, the House Bill 2 thing, and that's got to be part of this. That's got to be a deeper layer. That's part of the rift between these two. So I wonder how much that has played into it. And at this point, we've moved completely away from having a conversation about mental illness, about how these situations should be handled, if they can be handled better, if this is just the cost of doing business. To me, there are a number of things that are not really part of the dialogue at this point. We've got Senator Berger trading barbs or throwing barbs at the mayor. I mean, the whole thing is a mess, and I think we've just moved away from any place of a reasonable conversation. One thing to point out, I think that is important, is we've heard these calls from Berger and McCrory for Mayor Roberts and Kerr Putney, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg police chief, to release all of the dash cam videos, not just some of them. Well, it is worth noting that Frank Perry is the Secretary of Department of Public Safety here in the state, oversees the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation, and it is also handling its own inquiry into this matter. They also have the tapes. They have all the dash cam, the footage from the calls I've made and the people I've spoke with. DPS has not called me back to just put that on the table. But I'm unaware of anything that prevents them from releasing this. So
right.
It is political in nature, right? I mean, McCrory saying, you know, you got to release these videos, blah, blah, blah. As far as I understand, he could, you know, order the release of them himself. And that hasn't happened. So you asked a question. I didn't answer
it. But he's clearly trying to score some political points. We saw Phil Berger this morning release a letter that he sent to the mayor also. And that really is confusing with the law that was passed. And, you know, he says you should release them now, but while you still have the chance. Well, his legislative body passed the law that would not make it so they couldn't release them after this,
right,
or that a judge would take over that decision.
Right. So here's the subject of that, just to follow up on that. The subject of the email that Berger's office released this morning. Berger to Charlotte Mayor, release videos today, September 30th, or else court may force you to once new law takes effect. And this is one of these moments where you're like, oh, I'm missing something. I'm wrong here.
I read it twice, and I was like, oh, wait a minute.
So the brief background on this is that tomorrow's October 1st, obviously, and a new law takes effect, HB 972. This is a law that pertains to police video camera footage. It is a law that was passed by the General Assembly that essentially makes this documentation, these recordings, no longer public record. And if you or I or anybody listening, if somebody wanted to obtain one of these videos, they would have to get a court order, which, of course, is a little more cumbersome of a process, right? You got to deal with bureaucracy. There's money. There's time that factors in. It makes it more difficult for these videos to come to light. And Berger is attempting to, the protest, Senator Pro Tem is attempting to turn this and say to Roberts, you have to release this today or else a court might order you to do so. Which is like, well, yeah, that's what the law is going to be. That's what you all have created.
Right.
And again, to me, it goes back to we're not talking about the issue at hand, which is lethal force. And that's at the heart of this, right? And we're not even having a conversation about it. One of the things that struck me outside of North Carolina in the last couple of weeks, we had the shooting outside of Los Angeles. We had the shooting in Tulsa. And one of the most interesting, not to be insensitive, interesting things from this was that we had police in both instances. There were two officers. One fired a gun, one fired a taser. Well, that to me, and I don't know much about law enforcement. I should know. What's going on there? Mm-hmm. Is this a training deficiency? Is this and that's an inconsistency, right? And that to me is something that should be addressed. I don't know if it can. I don't know, but we're not talking about something very functional here. Would a taser have worked? Could two people still be alive? Or did the officers who used the tasers in those situations, did they break protocol? Should they have been using their issued firearm? I don't know. But instead, we're talking about
the sort of political ramifications of this. But what's interesting, you mentioned sort of how there's really different ways that police are trained, the way they react to these situations. Well, there's different laws now in different states about the release or not release of this police and body cam footage or dash cam footage as well. The thing I found really interesting about Berger's letter today was he seems to be riding the public sense of we need more transparency, and yet he passed a law that I don't think anybody would argue reduces transparency.
Absolutely. And that's not even up for discussion.
Right.
This law removes transparency from the process.
And now he's playing this up as you need to be more transparent.
Right. And it is spin.
And that is the ultimate in sort of political spin.
Right.
And it is sort of, it's not unique for sure that the governor of a state disagrees politically and fights politically, publicly with the mayor of the city, of the largest city in the state, or any city in the state. You know, we think Chris Christie is a good example, New Jersey, who, you know, of course, Bridgegate and all that. That was very much a political fight with a mayor. This is an interesting thing to watch, though, because McCrory was the mayor of Charlotte and in 2012 won the governor election, a very close election, largely because he had a lot of support in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. Mm-hmm. And we've seen some of that erode. We've seen a lot of people anecdotally, admittedly, say that McCrory isn't the governor that I thought he was as a mayor. He's not the moderate that I thought he was.
No, absolutely not.
And he won that area, and we've seen, whether it was the I-77 toll issue, the Charlotte airport issue. Does this whole incident, whether it's the most recent sort of riots or any of those incidents, does it erode his popularity and his support in his hometown?
We can certainly say it doesn't help. As the population of Charlotte has changed, he hasn't been mayor there for a little while now. I think he was done. His last term ended in 07. So we're talking about 9 years.
Right.
He ran for governor in 08. He lost to Bev Perdue narrowly. He won 4 years ago. Charlotte has changed. Charlotte is bigger. There are a lot of people there that they don't recall him as the 7-term mayor, which he was. He was there for 14 years, and he's a lifelong resident of Charlotte. But no, I don't think that he can count on Mecklenburg being a victory for him come November 8th, come November 9th. And that is an interesting dynamic to this whole thing. To me, when it comes to the gubernatorial race, that is maybe the most interesting county because I would be a little surprised if he carries Mecklenburg County. I mean, you're talking about one of the bluest areas of the state, and you're talking about somebody who, yes, as a mayor, and we should note that in North Carolina, mayors don't have a whole lot of power. City managers do.
Right.
Governor McCrory has drifted very far to the right during his 4 years in office. Now, maybe he's always been much more conservative, and that's not how he was publicly in Charlotte. Maybe he's been pulled that way by the House or the Senate. Maybe it's purposeful. Maybe it was by accident. Maybe he got bad advice. Maybe he didn't listen to his advice. I don't know. But he's not a moderate. And I don't. You're gonna have a hard time finding
anybody who says that now.
Yeah.
Right.
Unless it's for political reasons.
But I couldn't agree more about Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. I think if you are interested in watching who's going to win the governor's race, and it's election night, and you're watching returns come in, you want to focus looking at that, because if McCrory is winning Charlotte or Mecklenburg County, mm-hmm. he's going to win the governor's race. If he loses, it's a lot more difficult. If he loses by 3-4 points or more, he's really going to have a tough time
right.
winning the governor's race.
Right.
You know, we look at Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina in the presidential race as being the bellwether that if one candidate wins one or the other, then it looks like it's going to go that way or the other way. In North Carolina, if you're looking at the governor's race, you're looking at Mecklenburg County.
You are. And I was trying to pull up the numbers here. I was not able to do it on the fly of where Mecklenburg went in 2012. I know they voted for him, but I think they also voted for Obama.
It might have been. It was super close. For both ways. And so
right.
I did look before I came in here, and I saw that he did win Mecklenburg County. He did not win it by much.
Right.
You know, he may not have to win it, but it has to be within 1 or 2 points because
right.
he's going to win the rural areas. He's not going to win the Triangle.
Well, not Nash County, not Rocky Mountain. Most likely. That's where Cooper's
sure,
from.
Sure, right. Yeah, yeah. Good point. And so, but Cooper will compete in areas, in rural areas, that maybe Beth Perdue did not because
right.
he is a
right.
son of the South, because he is
in
a
the
Nash
coastal
County.
Plains, yep. in kind of that eastern or northeastern region. Yes.
Dare County will be super interesting because mm-hmm. obviously Governor McCrory was a big supporter of offshore oil drilling, which was pretty unpopular along
right.
the coast. So
mm-hmm.
all of that said, I still think Mecklenburg County is going to be where it's at. And
right.
and watching him in this, you know, Jennifer Roberts has some support. She probably has quite a number of detractors about how she's handled things. It'll be interesting to watch because, it, you know, that the latest incident, you know, and we're talking still, what, 6 weeks now to Election Day, six and a half?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a lot can happen between now and then to change people's minds. On the governor's side.
Right, and that's just the governor's side. I mean, what more influential is going to happen with the Senate race between Burr and Ross? Is there anything that tips the scales that really angers people? And, of course, the driver of the whole thing is Trump and Clinton. And what happens if, you know, there's a series of emails that are leaked? I mean, we've heard from Julian Assange that emails are coming. You know, we've heard from Trump that there's going to be potentially, you know, another bombastic statement in the next debate over Bill Clinton and his infidelity. I mean, how does that tick people off, drive them to the polls, send them at home, whatever the case may be? And I think that is also a big driver. It's October tomorrow. I'm ready for the October surprise.
Well, one of them might be for the governor's race, October 11th. It's the debate night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw a pretty historic debate in the presidential election this week. It was, you know, I was taken by it as well, and I heard a lot of the pundits afterwards saying this, whatever you think who won or who lost, that was a debate unlike any other we've ever seen. I don't know that the debate for the governor's race on October 11th is going to have that much of an impact, but it is the only one. And while McCrory and Cooper have fought in the ads and they've, you know, fought on the airwaves, this is the time that they're going to be next to each other. It's going to be a for those who care and for those who watch it, and that's not going to be everybody who votes, certainly, it's going to be a major thing. It's going to be really interesting to see how the two interact and how they compare to one another, and it's the only one. How important is that debate going to be in the race, do you think?
It's different than when they debated back in June, right? Because at that point, Cooper was ahead
right.
in most polls, 3 to maybe 6 or 7%. And it felt like McCrory was playing a little bit more of a challenger's role. We have seen polls more recently that have them closer to one another, and I wonder how that will affect his mannerisms, how it is, you know, he argues, or how contentious he, the governor, is on stage, because he's not playing from at least a perceived place of trailing as much as he was 3 months ago. I think it's as significant as any debate, which is, well, what is that going to mean? Maybe a spike or a bump in the polls of a couple of points coming out of it. I don't think it's going to be monumental.
Really?
I don't think it's going to shift this thing. It's, you know, we've talked about this before. How many swing voters are there really? How many
right.
people haven't decided come October who they're going to vote for or if they're going to vote at all? It'll be interesting to me some of the topics. You know, I think there are some things that are pretty ripe for exploration with both of these candidates. You know, we had an email exchange here among our staff recently talking about, you know, questions to ask the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be pretty fascinating to pose a question to Roy Cooper about Medicaid expansion and how in the world he plans on actually getting that done with majority. There are going to be majorities in both chambers.
Right.
General Assembly of Republicans, of the opposite party, of his opposition. I mean, he's talked about Medicaid. Is that just lip service? Is he really going to move on that?
Yeah,
and if
how
so,
hard
how? And what is he going to sacrifice? I mean, you only have, you know, so many pillar issues, staple issues you can get behind. So I'd love to hear that come up. I think it'll be interesting to hear, you know, how much Governor McCrory can, you know, eloquently articulate the success of the economy here and stay away from some of the nonsense. Or does he jump back into House Bill 2? And I also think it'll be interesting to see if we get any questions about access to abortion. And, you know, this was a campaign promise of his 4 years ago. McCrory, he said he wasn't going to introduce any further restrictions as it pertains to women who are attempting to get an abortion. And General Assembly has sent him bills on two different occasions during his first 4 years in office, and he has signed them. And both of them expanded restrictions for women seeking an abortion. So I think maybe this is just me, the journalist talking. Reporters, moderators, whoever the panel is, I probably should know at this point, but I don't. People asking the question could make this more interesting than either of these two, because I don't think that they have a whole lot to gain by spicing it up. As we've said many times, Cooper's not particularly dynamic. McCrory can be pretty thin-skinned. Neither of those things benefit them at this point, right? Like, McCrory needs to talk about the economy. Cooper, I don't know what he needs to do. I mean, he could be a little more dynamic and personable, but I don't think we're going to get that on October 11th.
What's interesting, too, I was thinking about this as you were talking there, you know, about what issues end up being, you know, brought up during this debate. You know, the moderator is Chuck Todd, NBC. So
that's right. Sorry. Hello. I knew that.
So if he's the moderator,
let's go, Chuck.
Now, is he going to focus on the specifics of Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, or is he going to look at HB2?
If you're
taking a plane out of Washington and rolling into Raleigh and hosting this debate, your mind is, here's what I know about North Carolina. HB2, I know, you know, the riots in Charlotte. And if those two, if HB2 becomes a major part of this debate, that's not to McCrory's favor. It's just not, because we've seen polls that are very supportive of, or I'm sorry, very opposed to HB2 in general, but more about the economic impact of HB2. And most people believe it's been had a negative impact on how North Carolina is perceived. So if he's talking about that, and if the debate is about that, it doesn't seem that that's a positive. If it's about the economy, he's got stronger footing there. He can make arguments. Now, whether you agree with the arguments or not, that depends, but he can make some economic arguments. That's clearly where he wants the conversation to be.
But is that sexy? Is that that exciting?
And if you're McCrory and care
you
about need, that.
Right. But if you're McCrory and you're trying to get people out to the polls, if you're concerned about lower voter turnout because of Trump, and I don't know if that's still a concern. It has been, you know, in recent months. Do you really want to be talking about unemployment?
Right.
That's not spicy.
No. But that's what he wants to talk about. We've seen that.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see. So let's talk about something that was spicy, the presidential debate. You were watching it with some folks on Franklin Street. What were your general takeaways from the debate? How it's going to impact North Carolina at all, undecided voters here at all, and what did you hear from the folks who were around you that night?
Those are too many questions for me to keep in my head.
Let's start. Tell us where you were and who you were talking to.
I was on East Franklin Street in Chapel Hill at a watch party sponsored by Fox News. I had been turned down by Republican county parties to go to a couple of watch parties. I won't name the counties, but a couple of counties in the Triangle. Wake County was not one of them. And went to East Franklin. It was a bipartisan crowd. There were 150, 200 students there from UNC, Duke, Elon, NC State. I chatted with, I don't know, half dozen to 10 of them. And I spoke with a number of, I talked to a couple of Trump supporters, but the majority of people I talked to were undecided and really not impressed with either of the candidates. And I think this probably speaks to my lack of decades upon decades of political experience. This was obviously testy, and this wasn't particularly presidential or collegial, but it wasn't that surprising to me. I was reminded years ago, for a long time in Winston-Salem, I would get my car fixed by this guy named Ralph, who moved down here from New York City. Ralph, he was a good cat. And Ralph would carry on about politics and just how divisive they had become since he started first watching debates in like the late 60s or early 70s. And it drove him nuts when people would interrupt and talk over each other and just completely avoid questions, and the moderators wouldn't keep them honest. I think that's just what we've got these days, right, in American politics. So I wasn't you know, I wasn't blown away by either of them. I thought the best moment of the debate was the most honest moment, about 80 minutes in, after Trump was carrying on about something. I honestly don't remember what it was. And then Hillary did her shimmy.
Mm-hmm.
She just shook her shoulders and goes, "Whoo!" That to me was one of those moments. I don't know. We'll see if it carries through or resonates or not. But it, I felt like if you were on either side of the aisle, it was almost one of these things where it was like, yeah, we've all felt that a little bit in the past few months. Like, whoo, are we still talking about this? Like,
yeah.
What is this whole thing about? What was your next question?
I was just, you know, what was interesting to me about where you were is that there are people who care enough to go to a debate watch party,
mm-hmm.
who still are undecided. You know, we think of undecided
right.
voters as mostly being a group of people who
right.
really, for in an amazing way, really, you'd have to sort of tune out all media, not paying attention, you know, or not, you know, they're undecided because, they're going to wait till close to election day, and if they vote, they're going to go out and pick the person who, you know, whatever. But to think that there are people out there paying close enough attention who care enough to take a night to make their way
right, who are pretty,
to East
these
Franklin
were intelligent
Street.
People, and they had articulate thoughts on this.
Sure,
yeah.
And they're still undecided. I find that to be an amazing situation. I think, and who knows, right? They may be more decided than they're letting on, but also,
sure.
I think you take them at their word, too, right? They're undecided.
I talked to one law student, and he made a comment. I wish I had listened back to it before we recorded here, but he said something to the effect of, you know, Trump really concerned me. You know, his economic approach is similar to a post-industrial 19th century, blah, blah, blah. It was like, whoa, like, yeah, you are a Carolina law student. And it was like, you really haven't decided? Like, you've given
yeah.
it this much thought, but you haven't decided? And to me, it's like, what's going to tip the scale? Like,
right.
What is going to settle it for
what's
you?
What's going to make your decision for you?
We've got pretty hefty resumes or pretty hefty files on both sides. So I don't know.
The one thing I've seen in the whole presidential race, and we'll end it up here because you know, we're running a little bit short, but one of the things that I've found interesting was that Trump's numbers among Republicans, support among Republicans, has continued to rise. And he's at somewhere in the mid to high 80s of percentage of Republicans who intend or have said they intend to vote for Trump. And the Republicans say, you know, and that's why it's gotten so close, because as he's gained, or as Republican voters have come to the conclusion that he's their guy, they're going to vote for him. Some of them may be more enthusiastic than others in doing so. If he gets to 93% of Republicans voting for him, then a lot of people think he's got a real chance. And that's the one thing I think that, you know, everybody talks about unaffiliateds or people talk about independents, but Trump has made all of his gains among Republicans.
And the swing states are close.
And the swing states are always going to be close. And North Carolina, whether you look at 538 or Real Clear Politics, anybody, is probably going to be, again, this year, the closest race. And as the demographics change and as people's ideas change, it's only going to get closer. It's only going to become more contentious in this state. And we've seen that not just in the presidential race, but also in the governor's race.
I'm buried in my phone over here because I'm trying to pull up the 1992 presidential election results, just because I think it's worth noting, and I don't think we're going to blow people away with this. I can't find off the top of my head, or excuse me, off the top of my phone. I'll see if I can. The short of what I'm trying to get at is, you know, we've heard for a while that Trump can't win, which is nonsense, and if you're still hanging on to that, good luck to you. What I'm reminded of, and one of the criticisms that's come up with Trump is, oh, you know, he can't carry more than, you know, 40, 42, 45% of the electorate, right? Like, we've heard that. I mean, I've heard that argument.
Mm-hmm.
We should note that Bill Clinton didn't carry a majority of voters in either of his elections, in 92
right.
or in 96. And the number that's in my head, I'm trying to find it, and maybe we can fact check it or something like that. But the number in my head is that Bill Clinton carried like 42% of the vote
right.
in 1992. All right, I think I found it here. Bill Clinton carried 43% of the vote. George Bush carried 37, and Ross Perot carried 18.9% of the vote.
Well, and there's the factor, right? Because Gary Johnson's not Ross Perot. He's not going to take that.
Aleppo?
Yeah. He's not, and then
that
can't
president
remember,
from
he
Mexico?
Can't remember anybody's name who runs a major country that he admires. I mean, he's not going to get 18%. He's not going to get half that. He's not going to get, you know,
right.
and that's the sort of fact
right.
that makes it a little bit different. But
right.
your point is well taken. Like, Trump can win, and he doesn't have to hit 50.
No.
He doesn't have to get a majority at all.
He doesn't. So I think that is an important thing to think about as this as his poll numbers among Republicans continue to escalate? No. I mean, he's going to need, I think the winner's going to, excuse me, need more than 43,
yeah.
Unless something crazy happens. But, yeah, it's in play. North Carolina's in play. It's far from over.
Absolutely. Well, that'll do it for the WNC Politics podcast today. Thanks, Jeff.
All right.
Please review, rate us on iTunes and Google Play, where you can also subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast. And please check out WUNC.org for all of our political coverage. See you next week.